that the charge, stored charge, could be liberated on demand at a sufficiently high rate of power that it could be useful for something, either from the point of view of light or mechanical energy.
Mm-hmm.
But that was, from the point of view of light, that was before electroluminescence was discovered by Richard Burroughs.
I guess I'm interested in what you and Heeger were doing to build credibility for this. I mean, you talked about how you were very much outside both synthetic mm-hmm. chemistry and physics. What were you doing to kind of get over those barriers?
Mainly to try to come out with research which was not slapdash, which was solid, so that if people could not criticize it as being done sloppily. I think our feeling was that good, solid chemistry and physics would stand the test of time. It's sort of interesting. One of my things that sometimes people say, well, you know, it's great to have papers in science. I haven't had a paper in science. My feeling was that I'm interested in doing certain things. Before publishing something, I make sure that other people in the group can reproduce the work without speaking to the person in the group that has done it, but will have a manuscript and say, okay, Joe, see if you can reproduce the work there without speaking verbally to the other person. So my feeling is good, as Emmelaus used to say to me, he said, theories come and theories go, but experimental facts go on forever.
Mm-hmm.
So, you know, I was interested. And so the feeling was, I'll chug along at my own slow pace, trying to do reliable experimental work. And as Emmelaus said to me when I left his group, he said, laddie, do not go after the big fish. The big fish, if they're going to come, will come along in good time. Just keep your nose in front of the scientific, keep your face in front of the scientific public, and make sure that your experimental work is reliable and reproducible, whatever it is that you do.
Mm-hmm. So were you choosing measurements to make based on interest, but then trying to do them as reliably as possible to show that this field was credible? Or were you choosing measurements that would demonstrate credibility to these communities?
Well, our key thing was to create credibility to ourselves. Can we reproduce an investment, or is it due to something is wired the wrong way?
Uh-huh.
And then when we found we could reproduce it, then we'd say, ask Alan Heeger, okay, if he could do a proper physical measurement. So it's interesting, on one occasion, at the very early stage, we found we very much needed a good physicist. So I asked a certain physicist in the physics department if he would do some measurements. And we arranged to have lunch together at Houston Hall. And we were walking up the little side path, and I was telling him, won't say his first name, but I call him Joe. And I said, could you do some good temperature studies and others on it? And he said, Alan, forget it. It's just a junk effect. So I said, Tony, if it's just a junk effect, and if you know what the junk is, and you know how to put it in controllably, and maybe take it out controllably, couldn't you call it a doping effect? He said, it's not single crystal, it's crappy stuff, it's junk. So I then got Al Heedler interested in it. He said, give it a shot. And as a matter of fact, with one of our papers, with Alan and this other person who are called Joe, the three of us were in a small room trying to write up a paper together. And Alan Heedler, this other person, had a tremendous fight. And one of them walked out of the room and left me alone in the small room with the paper, with the manuscript together. And this person who I was left with said, well, you'll have to make a decision whether you want to go with collaborating with me or with Heedler. And so I thought about this, and various reasons I decided to that I'd feel more comfortable collaborating with Heedler. This other person, physics department, would quite often pass on 33rd Street, and I'd say, oh, good morning, blah, blah, blah. Just hold his head as you walk by. But finally, after 7 years, he spread down.
Tell me a little about some of the work that I know you're interested in, and I know also was associated with the NRL, crystal electroactive polymers, and this molecular electronics idea of the spun fibrils of the organic conductors.
Are you referring to electronic weaving, placing things at very high potentials? Actually, we were the first people to apply this to conducting polymers on the lab bench right over there. And we published a couple of papers on that. Because what do you do? You know, have a hypodermic needle, and this is the repellent part. And then we'll hold this at, say, a positive 30,000 volts. Have a piece of aluminum foil, which I bought from the kitchen at ground. And then you break down the surface tension here, and it zooms over, and you've got a whole mass of electrospun fibers collecting here. But we had thought that holding the potential at 35,000 volts, shooting this through air and oxidizing agent, that would finish up with stuff that was oxidized, shooting this high potential through the air. But we were surprised it didn't, and we published a couple of papers showing that we had this, we collect the fibers here. And then we take some of the solution that we had here before we use it for electrospinning, and make a film of it. The infrared and the visually spectrum of the film cast from the solution before we did the electrospinning, and the fibers over here was identical with no visible change. So I think the electrospinning is a very, very interesting way of getting nano fibers. Although you feel that the method shown here are very much more convenient, but the fibers are not as long. But getting the fibers. These are all about the same diameter as the electrospun ones, but they're not so long. I on this particular thing, I don't have the smaller magnifiers. The average diameter of these is around about 32 nanometers. So I think the electrospinning has got a lot of very interesting aspects to it. We're actually using now some of the electrospinning aspects in the bioalcohol, biodiesel. It's using a completely different, using the concepts in a completely different way.
What was the motivation to begin making these spun fibers?
Just fun. What's his name? The person at the University of Ohio, or Rensselaer, no, in Ohio. Just forgotten his name at the moment. He'd done some very, very good, very nice work on electrospinning. And we thought, I wonder if we can electrospin electronic polymers. Anyway, electrospinning started off in the early 1930s with sealing wax. The person was playing around with sealing wax and at a high potential and found he got these thin fibers. I'm not sure whether we had a electrospinning thing set up. Just hang on a minute, I'll come back. I think there are really real possibilities. One of my former students, Chen Shah, Chinese origin at the University of Washington, has done a very nice thing as the ground electrode. He has put instead of having one flat sheet, he's had two electrodes very close together, and then he can say two electrodes at ground, 35,000 volts different, and he can get fibers coming across the line, which is very, very nice indeed. So I think one of the things we have to get fibers that are aligned and in parallel. They're very interesting. Of course, that starts getting closer to carbon nanotubes. It's another fascinating area, and that worked closely with Ray Bachman in Texas and Dallas. It's also a very good personal friend. Let me bring you something about the carbon nanotube. These are carbon nanotubes fibers. And he's grown these by having so-called forests of carbon nanotubes. Then he had a very, very good Chinese lady who was with him, May, that she used toothpicks to pick them out. This was based on Ray's interaction, a person from Australia who's an expert in taking sheep's wool and spinning it into yarn, and can pick this out. It's quite remarkable. matters to me. Capital management. However, that is another huge area in itself. So I think this, I'm trying to think of any other interesting or important aspects. I think one of the key things is, from the point of view of the future, we do not yet know why different conducting polymers or different wavelengths give different conductivities. There are various theories. We do not yet know whether conducting polymers can be made which will have a higher conductivity than the best electronic conductors known, copper, silver, and gold, room temperature. We do not yet know. Well, firstly, there's no upper limit that has been suggested by theoretical physicists or chemists as to what is or could be the upper limit to conductivity of a synthetic metal. It would seem that having a highly aligned, highly crystalline material is necessary, just as if you have a nylon, if you stretch nylon thread, then you make it more crystalline, therefore much stronger. So nylon stockings and clothing is all made from highly crystalline nylon thread. But the upper, no upper limit has yet been projected for the conductivity of a synthetic metal. Furthermore, from the point of view of superconductivity, we know that organic charge transfer compounds can have superconducting transition temperatures. I think the highest is about 12 degrees Celsius at the moment. 12 degrees absolute at the moment.
Yep, right.
There is no reason to believe that you cannot get superconducting organic polymers. None have yet been made, but I feel it is highly likely that superconducting organic polymers will be made. I don't think anyone would try to look for these research-wise. It's like the Holy Grail. You always look for it, but you keep your eye out for it, but you never really expect to find it.
Right.
But if you do find it, you'll grab it first. So I think the upper limit is not known. I think my own feeling is that we will get much higher conductivity, but it will be discovered more or less accidentally while looking for some other property. That superconductivity, there's no reason why superconductivity at some given temperature in organic polymers should not be discovered. So I think the sky is still the limit, but I think that the research in the future in this field will be driven by industrial technological developments, and somewhere along the line, either by accident or by doing an experiment for a different purpose, superconductivity or very high conductivity will be observed.
Mm-hmm.
At least there's no known reason to say it cannot be.
Right. Tell me a little about the field of molecular electronics. I've heard speakers refer to you as one of the grandfathers of molecular electronics, and some of the early people who said that what they were doing was molecular electronics, like Mark Ratner and Arya Viram and Forrest Carter, all referenced your polyacetylene work.
Right.
Was that a community that you were close to?
I think the term molecular electronics is a very nice sexy term. I think it means a different thing to every person that uses the term. I think the main thought is centered around getting PN rectifying junctions, Schottky junctions, metal semiconductor. I really don't know exactly what is meant. Now there are other thoughts that you can get, say, a PN junction with two molecules, putting two molecules together.
Mm-hmm.
I know it has been, people have suggested that they've done this experimentally. When you get to that stage, then there's so many questionable parts about the experimental techniques. When you get through down to single molecules acting, then how you connect them up to the electronic equipment to measure them. So I feel that it is highly possible and probable that whatever we mean by molecular electronics field will develop. I think that means, my wife calling me, I will have to dash, I think, soon. I'm sure you will too.
Yep.
The thought of having complicated electronic equipment, calculators, the size of the pin of the head, I think is quite possible. I don't at the moment see how,
mm-hmm.
but I think it is possible, partly science fiction. When we think of Buck Rogers having his wrist rod
right.
Watch radio, which was science fiction then, but is now quite reasonable.
Mm-hmm.
I think when people talk about molecular electronics, they tend to be talking about two perhaps rather complex organic molecules, or even one molecule with one end sort of being a P and the other N type, but still one molecule, but which will act as a PN junction, which of course has many applications. So I think it's fascinating. I think that the term molecular electronics means something different to everybody that uses the term. But there I get very lost.
Mm-hmm. Well, in your Nobel lecture, you have a section on nanoelectronics. Were you from the beginning thinking about how to look at electron transfer through smaller and smaller amounts of these organic conductors, or did that come later?
Looking more at nano, but not molecular.
Uh-huh, right.
Molecular, I think, very much refers to perhaps one molecule in itself acting as a peer junction.
Right.
Nano, looking at reducing things in size very much. So what, one of the things was thought of quite a lot. Normally you think if you're going to make a p-n junction, you'll have a flat surface here and a flat surface here. The thing involving electric spin and others, there's no need to have this as being flat surfaces. One of the things we're interested in is having onion skin layers, having one a wire, a thin, which could be a nano fiber, but having layers of different P or N doped polymers or thin films of metals to get p-n junctions. So if this was say a metal here, and then you had a layer of circular layer all the way around it, then you could tap this, then you could have the p and n junction, or multi layers, and just have them offset from each other, so you could then tap separate ones. And that comes in, say, the tapping. How does one make, as you get smaller and smaller, how do you make contact with the outer world with electronic equipment? My thought is here, we should not consider putting a wire or soldering iron, soldering something on. One should consider non-mechanical contact way of tapping with the outer world. From the point of view of say if you've got a tiny little some sort of micro p-n junction or something in the blood vessel, then having a capacitance meter on the outside so you could see where it is moving. So I think, or using a field effect, like field effect concept. I think the point of view is smaller and smaller and smaller, but how the hell do you tap that into the outside world to know what you're doing? So I think we have to put much more emphasis on considering how you make contact with the outside world. And I think that we're all very accustomed to field effect transistors, to making use of electric fields or magnetic fields. And I think we need to do more concentration on non-mechanical contacts.
Uh-huh.
Sometimes I think we need to look back at past crude work in the past and see how using new concepts, new techniques, new types of apparatus, new chemicals, how we can use old stuff from the past and build on that for new concepts and techniques.
Mm-hmm. Wow. But at what point did you begin thinking about miniaturization with your conducting polymers? Was that there from the beginning, or did that become more and more of a focus?
No, I think this became more and more of interest when we got into the electrospinning.
Uh-huh. Okay.
And found that we could make smaller fibers, and then say, okay, now how can we use the smallness
mm-hmm.
for anything? And then with this sort of thing here, having this, can we use it for anything, or is it just nice to say we've got a bunch of stuff that's 1/500 of the diameter of here? Okay, it's fine.
Mm-hmm.
But can you put it to any use?
Right. So I know you should probably be getting home. Should we we plan to maybe meet for just a very short session some other time?
Yeah,
I'd be
delighted.
Okay, great. And in the meantime, we'll begin processing what we have so far. And
I forgot to ask you, what is the main thing that you want to do?